Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right, Kyle, how are you, man? Thanks for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it. How you been?
Great, Don. Thanks. It's been a fun couple of weeks since the kids have left university here in Arkansas, but enjoying the different pace of the work.
Yeah, it's a fun time of the year. Do you and your staff take any like time off?
I think the most common time for the majority of college soccer coaches to take off, there's probably in and around Christmas, right? And then in the summer, it's probably middle to late June, right? Maybe after 4th of July, because once July starts turning around, then you got summer camps mostly dominate the July kind of time frame, and then season starts pretty quickly, right? When you got guys coming in, I mean, our guys are reporting, I think, July 23rd. So, the regular season starts, August 4th, I believe, is the first NCAA day. So that's kind of what the calendar looks like a little bit in the summer.
Yeah, it's people don't understand there's not a lot of downtime for a college coach. And it depends on the level. When I coached a junior college, I'd take almost a month off. But when I was in the NCAA, there wasn't a lot, not a lot of downtime.
No.
What are you guys working on right now? What's the main focus when you guys are in the office right now this time of year?
Yeah, I think the main focus is, we've got one more spot that we're trying to fill within our roster to kind of be at 28 and be done. So we're still kind of looking around there, picking through everything from, portal, junior college, current guys that are out there, gap year kids, internationals, like just still kind of keeping our fingers in every pot and looking around to see if we can find the right guy. We just had a meeting this morning and I said to the guys, like, look, we've taken shots on a few guys and have missed so far in this position. But ultimately, whoever we bring in, the most important thing to me is that we need to believe in this person. We don't need to just bring a body in here, right? So we need to believe in this person as we want that person to come in and have a space to grow and then ultimately, be the player that we want them to be. So we have that. And then one of the unique things here at UCA is we have what's called the soccer house, and that is our office, team room, locker room, and everything is in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, old kind of ranch style house that sits on the campus.
Cool.
At
I
UCA.
Love that setup.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. We really love it. And it provides a unique feeling to the program. We like to say, like, our facilities are very warm when you come in here. It may not be the most glamorous thing or whatever, but it feels like home, right? You've got a kitchen, you've got a cafe area where the guys can kind of sit in the lounge. You have team room with the PlayStation and I brought my old record player in from college that's there. So like, we have those things. And then it's functional as well. We have our office spaces and things that we're using that we maximize for video and meetings with players. But one of the cool things about the house is we do our own little improvements on it. So as a staff, one of the things that we're doing right now is we're redoing our boot room / breezeway where the guys come in and go into the locker room every day. So we're doing some painting, some construction and stuff in there. My father's retired. He lives in town. So he's kind of involved in it as well, as we're just trying to make the experiences as best as we can for every individual that comes in here while being resourceful.
Yeah, it's I like that setup a lot. I that was kind of always my dream as a coach, to have a setup like that where you could have everything in one place, because a lot of coaches have to deal with their offices in one building and then the yeah. team rooms in another building, and then the locker rooms are in another building, and a lot of moving around. At least that was my experience as a coach, and I always dreamed of having everything in one place. I like that. I like the idea that the place the kids can come hang out, maybe watch the Champions League, things like that. Yeah.
Yep, they do that pretty consistently here.
Yeah, what a difference that makes. That's cool. How far are you guys away from like administration? How do you deal with having to deal with them? Are you far enough away, or is it pretty close?
No, I mean everything at UCA is it's really convenient, right? Like honestly, to be able to get what you need, the only time you would really need a car is if you want to drive to the grocery store and get groceries or go into town
Okay.
or take the, you know, hit the highway, go down like 25, 30 minutes down to Little Rock. But you know, it's really convenient. So the university really sits on the 3-4 blocks within the middle of the city. Administration is at the football stadium up on the 4th floor. Whereas we're in the house on the south side of campus, or sorry, yeah, the would be considered, yeah, the south side of campus. So, you know, we're never too far away. However, like, you know, we're not a couple offices down where administration's knocking on the door and saying hello all the time either. You know, there's positives and negatives to that, you know, a little bit of separation, which is not always a bad thing, but at the same time, you kind of lose that connectivity outside of maybe head coaches meetings or any like just required meetings administration wise that you have annually, where we all are able to get together.
Kyle, you've been around a long time. I mean, people, if anybody's watching this, it's like, oh, he's so young. No, he's been around a long time. You've got that youthful look about you, brother.
Hey, so
But you've
try.
been around not only a long time, but you've been at a lot of different places and a lot of different levels as a coach. And what I don't know. I don't know how to say this, but I've noticed that there have been more changes in college soccer in the past 3 to 4 years than I saw in the prior 30 years. And it's crazy how fast things have changed in college sports, not just soccer, but in college athletics. And how do you, I guess the big, highest level you've coached at is maybe your biggest school is maybe Dayton, which is a pretty big time program, and now you're at a solid what we would call mid-major. But what are the biggest changes from a coaching perspective that you've noticed over the past 3 or 4 years? Is there any one thing? Is it, the transfer portal and how transparent it is now? Or what? Or is it the house versus NCAA settlement and NIL and revenue sharing and 28-man rosters? I mean, we've had some really big changes. What's affected you guys the most?
Well, I think that's two different questions, right? Like in terms of what's affected us the most, and then, you know, all the differences and changes, how many changes that we've seen. We've seen quite a few. I think when I first took this position, I came in as the assistant coach supporting our head coach at the time, Frank Kolenstein, good friends. Mentor, someone that, you know, was obviously willing to move my family from Washington State to Arkansas to work for, and excited about the prospect of what we could do together, as well as like what my professional development could be under him, and then ultimately maybe have a chance of getting into a head coaching role in the future. So ultimately that kind of panned out. But when I took the position as the head coach in December of 2024 and then going straight into 25, it's been nothing but changed on. Like it's been nothing but changes and new rules. It seems like every 6 months. At the time, it was me and our director of ops were what was left over from the previous staff. So I had to hire two assistants. We lost an assistant that it ultimately decided he wasn't wanting to stay in college coaching, wanted to make a change into a different profession. So then I had to rehire another assistant in the summer. Immediately we had Pavia that came into effect in December. So that actually influenced our roster because we had two players that were junior college players from Feather River that had 2 years left or had a year left. So we reapproached them just to see if they wanted to stay. So we had to kind of work through that. The transfer portal was already kind of a part of everything. But in terms of how much that's kind of affected, at least from the time that I've been involved in college soccer until now, it's definitely played a role. And then in the summer, we had house legislation go through. So then you had potential of opting in, opting out. Every division, every department kind of had to make their choices. Then you had the potential of, doing DSAs in the summer, how that was going to affect your roster. And then, before we get too far, you have NIL, right? And how that's affected things. So from a mid-major UCA perspective, I would say the biggest impact out of all of those things has been the House legislation, right? Because what you've seen in the House legislation, if we walk it back to, okay, NIL started, how much of an impact did NIL have on men's soccer from a men's soccer perspective? Not a lot. How many
Right.
NIL contracts were really out there? There could have been a few, maybe some of the bigger programs that were able to kind of be creative, or some of the NIL collectives grew to the point where the athletic departments at certain schools were like, hey, let's give some money to men's soccer. That was a positive. Maybe you had some super ambitious head coaches that went out there and found some things right away to help kind of get their guys in. But you got to remember NIL, what kind of things you run into there is, well, if you have an international student who's on that you're trying to put on an NIL, how do you work around immigration? How do you work around some of the rules and stuff there that are in place to be able to pay someone who's supposed to be on a student visa, right? For a domestic student, it's obviously easier, but there's still like, who are we attracting? What's the reasoning and everything that goes like? So I don't think NIL played that much of an impact, at least for men's soccer, so far. Now that may change in the future, but as of right now, I don't think that one's impacted as much as the House legislation has, because in the House legislation, yeah, the DSA thing is kind of interesting. You still have guys that can be on your roster past the 28 roster cap if you opt them
Designated, by
in.
the way, designated student athlete. Sorry to interrupt, but for those that don't know the soccer, we tend to throw around acronyms and soccer terms because we use them every day. But for parents that are listening, they're going, "What the heck is he talking about?" Designated student athlete. Describe
And
what that is, real quick.
again, another very weird one, right? House legislation gets approved. Basically, Congress says you have this short window of time to designate a student athlete to be on your roster and go past the 28. That player, it didn't matter if that player was on scholarship or not on scholarship. Like it was just, you just designate a couple of guys to be able to have more than 28 on your roster. But the only way you're able to do that is if your school planned to opt in by a certain date. And if your school didn't plan to opt into the House legislation by a certain date, then you lost your ability to create any DSA. So at Central Arkansas, the way that we decided to opt in was in the middle of the fall. We did not do it in the summer. So prior to that, there was a lot of different things that were going on at UCA. I mean, we had a reserve team. We had two teams here. We had carry I think we carried a squad of 32, 34. 33 going into the season, plus 15 extra on a reserve team. So that impacted how things moved pretty quickly in the middle of the season. And then in terms of just the overall sport, I think the House legislation has changed everything. And the best perspective that I can kind of give to everybody is think of how things kind of changed during COVID, right? During COVID, everybody came in at a certain, let's say, wealth perspective from family to family or industry to industry. However, if you entered into COVID with a little bit of extra capital, a little bit of extra money in your pocket, you were able to take advantage of all the chaos that was going on in COVID. Interest rates dropped to like 2%, if not lower. You could refinance your house. You could use that equity to go and buy some other stuff, or maybe invest into a second property. Like you could
Right.
do a lot of different things during that time if you had the capital. So right
Right.
now, I would say soccer is very similar. If your athletic department is willing to invest in your men's soccer program and go all the way up to the 28, or if not more, in scholarships, or they're willing to give you some of the revenue share money that comes through being a part of one of those athletic departments, then I think the change is very different in men's soccer than it has been. I don't think there's been any legislation that's impacted men's soccer more than that one there, right? Because I think the rest of them, we may have seen a little bit of knock-on effect, but now that you've seen some of these universities are expanding their scholarships all the way up to 28 or getting closer to the 28, whereas mid-majors, for the most part, have not changed. The finances just don't allow you to do that. So
Right.
you just can't, right? So you're still operating kind of under the old rules, while still being affected and having to compete with programs that are able to, stretch their budgets a bit further than what you can.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it affected 50 schools positively, maybe in the country that were able to just jump right in. Oh, great, fantastic. We can give 28 full rides now. And, you know, and everybody's going to get an extra maybe $1,000 out of revenue sharing, or 2 or 3 or 5,000 out of revenue sharing. So that's great. And on the women's side, we've seen there's a couple of power fours I know where girls are on full rides plus $100,000. Dollars. I haven't heard those stories on the men's side. They might
Yeah, no.
exist, but
I think,
not like I've
I
heard them on
mean,
the
you know,
women's
from the
side.
men's side, you're going to see, I mean, I don't want to name names, but there's players that are out there that are making some good money on a revenue share standpoint, but it's very specific to a program, right? And then it's also
And it's
comparable.
revenue
It's a,
sharing money too. I mean, we
yeah.
talked about NIL money and revenue sharing
Yeah.
money. I agree with you. I haven't heard a ton of people on name, image, likeness, NIL money.
Yeah.
Most of it's revenue sharing money because the football and basketball programs are making so much money that they've
Yeah.
decided to spread that money across the Olympic sports, the non-revenue sports.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, I mean, there's so many, like, you can dive deeper into the rules and how those things kind of work from, I mean, Title IX doesn't affect revenue share. There's no re they
Right.
don't have to share it. It really comes down to the athletic department deciding this is how we want to do it. And then, like I said, the NIL collectives, again, you can have an NIL collective. You've got so much in a pot and you decide, okay, we want to give it here and spread it out there and whatnot. So those are some of the things that are affecting, I think, the sport. But in general, from a men's soccer standpoint, I don't think anything's affected it more, and will affect it more into the future than what you just said.
Well,
Because
and all it's really
although,
doing, Kyle, is it's separating the haves from the have-nots. I mean,
yeah, and
it just means
in
that you're going to get less Marshall stories and less
yeah.
Akron stories of and maybe less Vermont stories, where a
Yeah.
team
And
comes out of nowhere and then wins a national title. I think we're going to see less and less of those underdog stories as, you know, as the big Power Four schools can just buy players, basically. They can buy whoever they want.
Yeah. But I think one of the things that's been fun to work in college soccer, and especially on the men's side, has been you always feel like you had a chance.
Yes, that's what
Yeah,
I'm saying.
and for a
Yes.
mid-major, it was always like, well, if we open up this new recruiting market, if we work really hard, if we work just a bit harder than the top dogs or what the name brand sweatshirt schools, maybe we'll be able to put together a roster that's unique that can compete and catch lightning in a bottle and have a chance, right? And that has historically happened. You've seen programs go from nothing to challenging for a college cup consistently throughout the years, whereas and Don, you would know better than me, because I don't spend as much time paying attention to what's going on in the women's game, but consistently
It's the same five schools, and it's
five
never
schools
gonna,
challenging for the
yeah.
national championship every year,
That's
right?
it.
So is that really what we want to turn it into? Like, I don't know, but how much of a say do we really have in it? Not a lot, because a lot of these rules that
Right.
we just mentioned, they're just knock-on effect. They've been implemented for one reason or another through the NCAA, and then there's just knock-on effect to them. So now that doesn't mean that you don't have schools out there that are maybe playing at not your Power Four conferences that can take advantage, because I would say even in the Power Four conferences in men's soccer, there's still some schools that are there, let's say in the Big Ten, that are still operating off the 9.9 or 10, or maybe they're a little bit higher, but they're not going all the way to the 28. Whereas a school maybe in the WCC is willing to say, well, we're going to go full in because we don't
Right.
have football and this is going to be our sport and we're going to make a go
Right.
for it, Right. So
Yeah.
that can still happen on the men's soccer side. But I think what you're talking about, if you got 50 schools that are going to go for it, how many outside of that 50 are making the 48 in the national tournament?
Right.
Probably you're probably getting that automatic bid, and then the first round of the tournament becomes really difficult
Right.
for that automatic bid team to compete. So we'll
And then
see.
you got to play
We'll see how
Stanford
that
in the
kind of
first
pans out.
round.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, yeah, but I mean, Stanford's got
Yeah.
their own challenges. You know what I mean? That's
Right.
that. I mean, yes, they've historically done really, really well. I have a lot of respect for Jeremy and everything that he's done and built program there.
Right.
But at the same time, he has his own challenges when it comes to the academics of getting a kid into school there,
And
right?
not to pick on
So,
Stanford, I'm just saying
yeah,
I'm just picking a name that people really
sure,
know that's won multiple national championships. I'm just picking a name. And you can pick
Oh,
another
you
name.
yeah.
You can pick Indiana, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
if you got to play Indiana in the first round, it's like, okay, how are we going to bunker in? What are we going to do? Let's really work on our set plays. Let's steal a
Yeah.
goal or two and
Yeah.
then pray that the soccer gods go our way and they hit the post six times.
Yeah.
You
Yeah.
know, I mean, it's just,
Yeah.
you know, it's going to be an uphill battle. You
For
know,
sure.
you know, it's not going to be even because, you know, that's a school, Indiana, that's got 28 fulls. And there's not a kid on that roster
Potentially.
that pays
Yeah.
for anything.
Yeah.
And you know, you got to compete against that. And you know, it's, and you know, that's a school that's, you know, deep in tradition. And that's always difficult. You know, when you get into a school that's won that many natties, you know, you just know that everybody knows how to win, and there's no nerves, and the nerves aren't the same as if you've made it
Oh
into the tournament for the first time. It's different.
yeah. Yes. Yes.
So not to pick on any school, and
Yeah.
there's six, seven schools in the country that we can name like that, whether it's Notre Dame or whatever. They're just really
Sure.
big names that have won nationals titles, and they know what it feels like. What about, look, here's the interesting but one that it's all in discussion still, and I don't know if it'll pass. I think it'll pass, but I don't know, and we don't know all the details, but that's the 5-and-5 legislation. So right now, for people that don't know, you have 5 years to complete four, basically. That's what it is. And there's really sort of no, I mean, there is an age limit, but you could, because you can take a gap year, right? So now if you graduate, so let's say you're German.
Yep.
Germans graduate at
Graduated
19.
19.
They don't
Yep.
graduate at 18, they graduate at 19. They have an extra year of high school,
Yep.
in what they call gymnasium. That's our high school. They graduate at 19. They can take a gap year, so now they're 20. But you could take 2 or 3 years, 21, 22, even 23, to bounce around in the Oberliga and the lower leagues and playing around, and then come to America and go, well, now I know I've only got 1 year of eligibility, but I'm going to come in as a freshman at 25, and I'm going to play for a year, and then I'll see what happens. So we're getting these situations where we have a 24, 25-year-old freshman. Yeah, they don't have 4 or 5 years eligibility, but who cares? The coach doesn't care. They're going to use the player for whatever time they have. The player doesn't care. They just want to extend their careers to see if they can get maybe picked up in the USL or MLS, or have an outstanding year in college and then go back and play pro. They're just trying to extend their careers. And the coach is just trying to win games. And the 5-and-5 part of the proposed legislation is that your clock will, you know, now start in a different way. So you're not going to be able to get a 24, 25-year-old freshman anymore. And that could affect schools like a Marshall that's been relying on older players, and there's a good number of mid majors, not to pick on Marshall, but there's a good number of mid majors that have made their teams really click on picking older international players, and building their teams that way, and that could change the dynamic too.
Yes, I mean, I think if that candidate, there's a couple different ways to view the 5 for 5. One, take it from an administrative standpoint, because I did a conversation with my athletic director about this the other day, because it just trying to forecast as much as we can in the future, how are things going to pan out, how's that going to change our strategy, and doing this, that, and the other. Because as you know, the recruiting it can happen in multiple ways. It can happen in, like, we do a traditional recruiting. We're almost like 6, 7, 8 months out, and we try to get the player to come in and bring them on a visit and get to know them. And then there's other types of recruiting that could happen really, really quickly, right? So, trying to get a grasp of how things are going to be 9 months from now is important, so that you can try to take advantage of it one way or the other. But when it comes to 5 for 5, the conversation from an admin standpoint, this is brilliant. Like, this is great. I don't have to file a waiver every other week. I don't have to worry about potential lawsuits. I don't have to worry about this, that, and the other. Like, I can have a for a mid-major, it makes it a life a lot easier, because typically at a mid-major, you've got admin and coaches fulfilling 2, 3, 4 different roles that might be held just by one person at a larger school. So from a value of life perspective, from a work-life balance standpoint, 5 for 5 sounds like a great idea for athletic departments. Right now, when it comes to men's soccer, specifically men's soccer, I raise a lot of questions, right? Because if I were to say the direction men's soccer should go, and this is taking into context my history as developing players or being involved in different development environments, whether it be in the old development academy or overseas in a full-time residential academy, right? And my essential philosophy on the development of players from a holistic standpoint, having somebody limiting the rules to 5 for 5, I think will ultimately hurt men's college soccer than it will help it, right? Because the level is going to change for them, or what's on the field. And then from a recruiting standpoint, you limit your pool, right? And then all of a sudden, we're going to become like other sports where the mid-majors don't have a chance. They can only recruit certain kids, right? And then when we go to these big recruiting events and domestically, everyone's going to be there, and you're going to have limited options on how to build your roster that we've had in the past to be able to compete, right? So it will just change the dynamics of the men's soccer landscape that's kind of been there for the past 20, 25 years, right? However, if I were to say from a developmental standpoint, some of the things that we may lose in this would be, let's take NCAA men's hockey, for example, right? NCAA men's hockey. Just last year in 2025 was the first time that they allowed legislation that they can now have junior hockey players go play junior hockey, which goes all the way up to 23, right? And come back and have full eligibility within the NCAA. It was the first time that they allowed that to happen, right? Now, men's soccer, in my perspective, from my standpoint, is very similar in the sense that your development, around the world is through those ages. And by the age of 21, 22, 23, if you haven't made it as a professional, then your chances of making it as a professional are even more limited. Now, that you have your Jamie Vardy stories, you have your stories out there where guys all of a sudden make it past that. And I think that that also plays a role in creating the best development environments possible. However, from a development standpoint, or from a competitive standpoint in men's soccer, if we move to this 19 age standpoint or cutoff date, the level of the overall games is going to change, and it's going to change for not just the teams, but for the American player. Right. So traditionally, what does the development track look like for the vast majority of American players? Well, they play club soccer, right? They play club soccer for 9, 10 months out of the year, right? In those environments, it can vary. You can have some environments where they train 4 or 5 times a week, one game on the weekend, or sometimes 2 times on the weekend, right? There's typically right now, there's a lot of travel involved. There's a lot of high cost involved, right? And then your goal is to either move into an MLS Next Academy and then eventually maybe make it into a professional rank. Or if that's not what your goal is, and your goal is ultimately to go to college, then at 18, 19, when you graduate from high school, you want to move into a university team, right? So but everywhere else, and even including in the United States, that your development doesn't all of a sudden just end when you graduate high school. You have the ability to be in other environments. So, for example, there's players right now, American players, who have played on amateur contracts through USL academies or MLS academies, have found their way back into NCAA rosters, and they've taken it, and they've taken advantage of certain rules that are available to them. What we don't do well in the American development environment is we don't provide places for kids to continue to play and improve outside of the college environments, right? And that's why we have this conflict where, okay, yeah, we've got the 21, 22-year-old international player dominating a lot of these NCAA rosters. It's because the 18, 19-year-old player that's coming out of high school hasn't been in the same environment. He can't compete with that player right now. He needs time, space, to continue to improve, but those environments don't exist except on college rosters for the vast majority of players. So if we change to this 5-for-5 model, you're going to change the environment where now you're going to be predominantly dominated with those club soccer players coming out of the United States and some international players being sprinkled in, but those international players now are going to be limited to what you just described. Maybe at 16, 17, and 18, they were able to go on and play in some senior level environments and bring that experience over to the United States, or they continue on to play in their own national youth leagues, under 19 leagues, and they bring that experience in. What you're going to miss out on is the more senior players that might bring a little bit more of experience, different life perspective to the teams, a little bit of diversity that exists throughout the majority of Division One men's soccer programs right now.
And it's interesting, Kyle, when I'm on social media a lot, and it never fails that when this topic comes up, the American parent, and it's always the American parent whose kid is bang on average at best, but their complaint is, what's keeping my kid from playing Division One soccer? Or even they even complain about junior college soccer or Division two soccer, or whether it's NAIA, it doesn't really matter. The complaint is, what keeps my kid out is the older American player. There should be no foreign players at all. They should be limited in age. If you allow them, they should be limited in age. But they really rail against the foreign players coming in. And from, I can look at this from a couple different perspectives. Having a son that went through the college system and played Division One and went overseas. I mean, he went overseas for 2 years and played in England and trialed in Germany and did all of that for a couple of years before he went into college. From that perspective of seeing that, Kyle, I saw a great value in playing with international players overseas, but in college too. He had, some New Zealand national team kids that he was playing with, and Australians and kids from Africa that he was playing with. And I think I saw it raise the level of the game here in the United States and in and amongst the Americans that were playing with those kids. It raised the level of the game, which is one of the things that any soccer enthusiast wants to see happen, is our level, the level of the game here in the United States, to get higher and to be able to compete with internationals. And I get concerned that if it's mostly only young Americans coming into the system playing against each other, that we'll see nothing more than a continuation of what we see in ECNL or in MLS next, because it's and which for me it's concerning. And I watch, I watch as much, maybe more soccer than even college coaches watch, just because of the nature of my job. And I see different levels, and it's very discouraging sometimes. You'll see the one or two standouts and you'll go, oh, that kid can play. And that kid could play anywhere in the world. You'll see those, and he's American, and he's 16, 17, 18, and he could compete in any academy anywhere in the world. You see those standout kids, they're usually on the national team. And we all know who they are. But then the other 80%, or 90% or 95% or more of the kids are, oh man, they got a lot of work to do, man. That there's a lot of work that needs to go on here, and they're gonna need time. And it, I think it, I'm all I am is reiterating in what you said, in that we need a system here in the United States for our Americans to grow up. I mean, you look at some of these 18-year-old kids, and they look like they're 15, developmentally, physically. They just haven't hit their stride yet, man. And they need that 18, 19, 20, even 21-year-old years to grow into their bodies and to figure the game out and to develop.
No, I mean, look, I think we're going to touch on a lot of different things in this discussion because there is so much to so many different perspectives to look at it from. You mentioned the parents and, why have I invested all of this money? Why have I invested in this experience? And
Right.
what's the opportunity available for my son in the at that next level? And I would, there's a couple of ways that I would kind of answer that question is like, one, the sport doesn't owe you anything, right? Like it doesn't owe you
Right.
anything, and that's something that you really have to have a hard conversation with yourself about is like, why am I in this? Why am I doing this? If you're
I
trying
like
to
that.
always, if you're involved in sport and you're looking for a strong return on investment from every experience that you have, dude, you're in the wrong business. And there's nobody that can tell you better than coaches, right? Because the amount of time, energy, effort that we pour into our teams and players, there's no way that the return on that is a positive return. It's not. Why do we do it? It's a passion project. It's a passion project. So, yes, I understand that the price and the cost of being involved in high-level view sport has only continued to rise in the United States. And that does add pressure and does and add, on families and stuff like that. And I get it in so many ways. I disagree with it, but that's not my job. You know what I mean? So I can't, as much as I would love to have an opinion and talk about how things can be changed. I know from my perspective as the college coach here, or as the head coach for the UCA, we're looking to develop a team, and we're learning that that's going to require me to attract talent as well as develop talent that is here. Because, like you've already suggested, at a mid-major, you go to the event, you're not getting the national team kid. That kid's going to the sweatshirt school, or he's going to go play an MLS Next Pro for 2 or 3 years. Right. So which players are we getting? We're going to get a player who might be, the island of lost toys, and we bring them in and we help them maximize their X factor, and we help minimize the things that they're not so good at, and we try to make them functional within our team. And then while we also try to build a strong team culture, we try to get their habits right. We try to develop them as people. Right. So those are the things that kind of happen within the college space. But at the same time, if your response to the decision that you're not good enough or you're not wanted yet, not right now, go and get a little bit better or go and do a little bit of this, is, well, we need to change the rules so that I can go now. What does that say about you? You know what I mean? I think we're in such a weird time. Not just in college athletics, but I think just in general in the United States and our country, that we just seem to be looking for more and more reasons to create elitism and exceptionalism. Like, we have to be an exception. And if I've done all this, I deserve this. Right. And I just think that those things are, they're putting there, those trends are taking us down a path that's not going to have good results in the long term. Right. You might get on, if that's the way you get onto a college roster, well, then yeah, you're on the college roster. Now what? You know what I mean? So those are things. And now, are there players that are not being picked up that maybe deserve to be picked up? I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are. There's not enough programs. We only have
No, there's
210,
not enough
211
programs, and the country's
men's
too big,
soccer.
Kyle.
It's
How do we
all of.
identify every kid? I mean,
No,
it's too
totally.
big of a country.
There's
We're
a
missing
lot. You've
kids.
got
We know that.
limited budgets. You've got limited recruiting budgets. You've got time. just as the resource, the greatest resource of all in any college soccer environment is time, right? How are we going to invest it? Where are we going to invest it? What are the returns going to be? Those are all things that are being missed in the conversation. But ultimately, if I were to say anything to the parents or clubs or whatnot that are in the United States and they're looking at this as being the golden parachute that's going to save them, I would just ultimately say, is that really how you want to make it? Do you want to win the lottery or do you want to work for a paycheck? Right? And if you want to work for a paycheck, there's certain things that need to change within our country systematically when it comes to developing players in order for us to develop a higher caliber of American player in the future. And it starts with the development academies, the development environments that we have outside of college before they even get here. And I think we need to create space and time for a kid to take a gap year or to find a way to play against senior players starting at the age of 16, 17, and 18. Without doing that, we're going to continue to create players that can only compete against 19-year-olds until they've entered the senior environment. If the college level is the first time that they've competed in a senior environment, then they're behind. Right? I mean, if you look at the way rosters are being built right now, you've got colleges taking, they're not taking freshmen. Legitimately have no freshmen on their team, right? Because they look at, well, this is a results-based environment, at least in my program. I'm here to win games, and to guarantee my ability to win games, I'm going to go get senior players who have already been tested, so that I know making sure it's a reality is that I'm going to have senior players that have already done it, and I'm going to get them from transfer portal, I'm going to get them from international market, I'm going to get them from JUCO environments. It's not going to be from the under 18 ECNL team. It's just
Now,
not.
you had mentioned junior college, and that's something. And it's, as you know, I coached at Feather
Yep.
River, and
Yep.
I started in junior college as the first place that I tried to step in and play after high school. And it's I think it's and it's and it's an area that I think gets overlooked by the American parent quite often. Because it's like, my kids work too hard to go to junior college. My kid's too good of a student to go to junior college. My kids, we paid too much money and invested too much in the system for my kid to go to junior college. And I tell you, there are so many stories of players that I've coached that played at the pro level that started out at junior college. Jeff Beicher comes to mind, who played for San Jose Earthquakes Clash back in the day, but started out and then at junior college and then went to Santa Clara and made a Final Four. And then, Andre Luciano on our staff started out at junior college and then went to Indiana for Pete's sake and was in a Final Four. And you talked about players that you picked up from junior college. What is so from your perspective, having coached at all different levels and in the Midwest, on the West Coast, now down in the South, what's your perspective of what's your advice and perspective on junior college to parents listening to this?
Yeah, well, first off, I think the biggest misconception right now around junior colleges is that if you play a year at junior college, it won't count for your NCAA eligibility.
Yeah, let's get
Just,
that out of the
let's go
way.
ahead and
That
get that
that's
out
a
of the way, right? Like, yes, it does count. So that was just a one-off thing that only happened with the Pavia ruling and stuff like that. So I think that that's something that, as funny as it just continues to linger in so many conversations that I
Yeah,
have in
good. I'm glad
recruiting
you
people
brought
time to
that
time.
up. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So knock that one out. I think it goes back to what I said before, elitism and exceptionalism. Right, you just mentioned it right. My son's worked too hard to be at a junior college. Can you compete? Can you dominate the junior college roster right now? Yes or no? Right. If you can, and you think that is why you should be recruited by a Division One university, well then find your way onto a Division One roster. There's ways to make it happen. We're pretty good at finding kids. I'm not saying we find everybody, but we find kids, right? So if you're good enough, I guarantee you somebody's talking to you. Right. But
Right.
when it comes to the junior college experience, what does it provide? Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's not easy. You know what I mean? You go in there and you've got to compete with players from all over the world, right? But I said, I'll tell this story, not necessarily junior college related, but just again, kind of hitting home on what college soccer really is. What was it? My third, I think it was my third or fourth year at Western Washington. We won, it was 2018. We won the GNAC for the first time in a while. I think since 2008. We were an automatic bid into the national tournament. We got a bye in the first round of Division Two. And then we went down to San Antonio. We played St. Mary's. St. Mary's was predominantly at, and you know, I think up until just recently when Midwestern State won the national tournament for Division Two, predominantly Division Two, when you look at the Final Four, it's all international. There's not a single division. There's not a single American on the roster, very rarely. So we went into St. Mary's. I think we had two internationals that were on our roster. Majority of our kids were from the Seattle, Washington, if not the Pac Northwest region. We went to St. Mary's and we got smacked. We got beat bad. I think it was 5-0. I think it was the end of the game, first round of the tournament. They had a star player. His last name was Wright. I'm pretty sure he plays at the moment for Hearts of Pine up in Portland, Portland, Maine, and USL One. We get done with the game, and one of our freshman midfielders, starting midfielder for us, was a Seattle Sounders product. Was on the way back to Bellingham, was mentioning that they had so many older players, and how am I as an 18-year-old supposed to compete against a 23-year-old that, you know, has a kid or something? You know, he's just making some comments, kind of complaining about the
Right.
game. And I was pretty upset with him. I just turned around and I said, "That's the game. That's football. Welcome to world football. You're not insular, right? You have to learn to compete against these level of players if you're going to make it, right? And if we're going to go and win a national championship here, which is our goal, ultimate goal, yeah, we still it's we're still going to recruit guys like yourself. You've done a really good job. You've had a great year, but now you just got a little bit of adversity on the field. What are you going to do? How are you going to respond?" And that's what it's going to tell more about yourself and the reasons why you're in this game than anything else, right? So again, for the junior college opportunity, I would say, what are your goals? What is it that you want to do? Why do you play this game? And then ultimately, from a cost perspective, you know, how much do you want to spend towards school? You know, because if you're going to a junior college, I guarantee you the cost for a community college are going to be a lot cheaper from than it is to take very similar classes at either a state or private school within the first year or two in the university. Now, one of the things I will mention is that transferring from a junior college to a Division One university isn't always easy, right? Because what we have at the Division One level that is different from any other NCAA level is we do have to meet progress towards degree requirements, and the college, every university is different in terms of which credits they're going to accept and how you're going to fit within a program, an academic program at that university. So that is something to consider, you know, as well as when you're in the junior college, are you taking the right classes to remain NCAA eligible within the first semester, second semester, third and fourth as you kind of finish out your time? Have we had junior college players at UCA? Yes. Will we continue to look at junior college for players? Absolutely. We're not arrogant enough to say that we can just ignore one area of player development over others. We have to continue to look in and decide. And I would say for the American player, if you're able to go into that environment, do well, both from a team and individual standpoint, then I think opportunities are going to be on the other side of that decision. But you know, you have to have an honest conversation with yourself and your family as to why you're trying to, you know, take this step. Why are you going to college? Why are you trying to play? You know, what are your reasons and passions for really doing it? So that when those tough days come, you know what you're leaning on.
Yeah, no, thanks, man. No, that I think that'll help some people. You and I kind of talked off the air before we started here, talked about the Scores Act. And I'm not very up to date on it. I'll say I'm a little embarrassed to say. But you guys have been talking about it as a staff, Administration's been talking about a little bit. What do you foresee? First of all, what is it? And then what do you foresee? How do you see it affecting college sports?
Yeah, so this one's a little bit different than five for five because this is Congress, right? This is law. This is conversations. The five for five might be a response to the executive order or the panel or whatever that the President Trump put together. However, the SCORES Act is kind of an ongoing discussion within Congress and how they want to approach college athletics. And basically, it's a student compensation opportunity through rights and endorsement. That's what SCORE stands for, right? And they're looking at everything from NIL clarification to athlete status and whether they're a student or an employee. They're trying to flatline some rules across the United States so that you don't have this variation from state to state based on different things. As well as kind of provide some other protections for the Olympic sports, requiring athletic departments to have so many sports in order to stay compliant, as well as providing some extra health benefits for players past graduation, right? So there's some positives and negatives in there. I think ultimately these are conversations that how it will affect men's soccer. It's another one that I think will be affected with a knock-on. We're not really involved in the conversation or not being at the
Right.
forefront of that conversation. It's going to be something that's decided based off of, Mississippi allowing a certain quarterback to have certain years of eligibility or, this, that, and the other. You know what I mean? It doesn't really have anything to do with what's actually happening at a men's soccer college roster, right? But if I were to put any opinion behind it, I just think what we've created since NIL revenue share and all that kind of stuff is we've essentially created a labor market. Kids are getting paid now. That genie is out of the bottle, right? In order for you to push that genie back in the bottle, I think is going to require some incredible gymnastics from our legislators and finding some creative ways to push back against what's already this vastly growing labor market. And that labor market doesn't just involve the players. You have now have people managing NIL collectives for players. You now have agents in so many ways kind of moving things around. So like there it's not just the players that could potentially be affected by something that goes through like this. But one of the things that I think is a huge missing piece in all of this discussion is I don't think that the players have a lot of say or representation in any of these conversations right now. I think they are being seen as children and they don't know what's best for them. And we're trying to make decisions that are best for administrations, bottom lines for universities, and ultimately fans, supporters of college athletics for two major sports in the United States, so that they kind of believe that there's not so much cheating or that there's a little bit more transparency on how this is possible or whatnot. And I think those are at the forefront of the conversation, and we're not having conversations about, well, if this is true, if this is really a labor market that's been created, then when does labor have any say in this? When do they join the discussion and have a bit of negotiation on in which direction this should go? And that could be dampened by this SCORES Act because essentially they're trying to block NIL conflicts with campuses. So if a kid having a conflict with let's say he goes and signs a contract with Adidas, but the school is a Nike school. It's a very
Right.
poor example, but I'm just providing something like that. Because you're a student and not an employee, do they remove your ability to collectively bargain? Right? Should the players have some type of representation or athletes have some type of representation to be able to negotiate from their side of the table instead of just strictly from legislation, strictly from authority or admin. And I think that's part of the conversation that's not taking place. And that's probably why, like, if you were able to create a CBA with the players, and that CBA was good for 5, 6 years, well, just like we have in the NFL or just like we have in the MLS, like, no player can sue against the CBA. You agreed to be a part of this, right? So that sets up the rules for at least that amount of time. That's my personal opinion on it. But in regards to the Scores Act and how that could potentially change things, we're looking at, yeah, a lot of legal processes put into place that's going to try. I think they're trying to go back. They're trying to go backwards more and more to what sport has traditionally been and in college in the past. And that's amateurism, and that's everything else that that universities have traditionally leaned on sport to be for their campuses.
You've mentioned two or three times about you've used the term knock on, but we're talking about this whole thing is being driven by American football and men's basketball because that's where the money is. I mean, without men's basketball, which is the number one source of revenue for the NCAA, and then American football, which is the number two source of revenue in the NCAA, without the top 50 schools in those two sports, the NCAA has no money. Dead on bankrupt. And the NCAA knows it. And the NCAA is desperate to hold on to those two sources of revenue. Otherwise, there is no NCAA as we know it today. And what's happening is soccer and whatever other sports, rowing, basketball, track and field, softball, whatever. All the other sports are being just drugged behind and hanging on for dear life. I kind of picture a water skier hanging onto the tow rope and lost the skis, but is tangled up in that tow rope, man. Can't let go, and the boat's not stopping. And the boat's just going as quick as it can, and we're just all being drugged behind while these other sports go on full bore. And what I'm hoping happens, Kyle, I'm hoping that American football, top whatever, Power Four, call it whatever you want, and basketball kind of break off into their own. Look, they don't need the NCAA. They've got plenty of their own revenue to be able to form their own whatever. And then the NCAA can just let everything else settle down. Because I don't know how Central Arkansas football and basketball is, but I doubt
What, the
they're
home of
making the
Scottie
kind of
Pippen?
money
Come on.
that Notre Dame is making,
Yeah,
you
yeah,
know?
yeah. Yeah.
And so what does that mean for mid-majors? And what does it mean, and because it has a trickle-down effect, Kyle. You know,
Yeah.
what happens at the very top affects the mid majors. What happens at the mid majors affects Division II. What happens at
Yeah.
Division II affects NAIA and junior college and Division III. It does have a trickle down effect because every kid graduating high school is just looking to play in college somewhere, and if they can't get into the top, then they get into the next level and the next level and the next level,
Yeah.
and there is a trickle down effect, but. I think I'm rambling.
It's okay. I mean, yeah, I think
There's
again,
so much here,
it's so much. It's
and
very,
it's so
very complicated.
connected.
There's an incredible amount of layers that you kind of have to siphon through to be able to finally get some semblance of truth, direction, or whatever to go with it. And I had a meeting with my athletic director last week, and I told him, like, this time is crazy. I really empathize with the amount of, like, effort that you have to put in to, like, kind of find a direction for us to go. And as the leader of our athletic department and the leader of the men's soccer program, having conversations about vision, goals, direction, it's impossible. I mean, you're trying to catch something that just can't be caught, right? So you're just trying to get, how close can we get? That's really all we're talking about, right? So what you're discussing right now, if men's football and basketball were to separate, I think it would, I don't know if it would be a good or a bad thing. This is what I guess I would say from a men's soccer perspective. We need to keep things. We need to be able to have a space to have conversations that are strictly in regard to our own sport, not holistic changes that knock on affect everybody. So go back to the eligibility 5 for 5 thing that we talked about before. You can have 5 for 5. If that's what works for football and basketball, then great. Let them do that, right? If that makes it easier for admin, if that makes it for better for rosters, if that makes it better for staff or for fans to be able to follow and things like that, great. But when it comes to men's soccer, does 5 for 5 work? In my opinion, no, right? Because I think the game is bigger. I think the recruiting landscape is different. And I think if we were to try to adopt that model, I think the overall level of college soccer would drop, and we would be reducing what this experience could be. I think the way that I would like to see US soccer in general grow is we have more environments where kids can take a gap year, or they have more environments where they're able to compete against men at an earlier level. And that level isn't just, men's league on the weekend. Like it's they're playing for something. How do we get there? If it needs to be, in so many ways, you mentioned that the US is so big, and that being one of our problems in terms of being able to develop players. I totally agree. Maybe instead of so much conversation about expansion, maybe we need to have more conversation about contraction and
I'm
say,
hearing
hey,
that a lot.
like, hey, well,
Regionalization is something that
regionalization,
coaches are
not
talking
just
about a
regionalization,
lot.
but state. Like, again, like I still work in ODP. And I know that ODP is kind of like a lost thing in so many ways, but like I still work at ODP because I do believe in that model in so many ways that like
I do
we need a
too.
space where we can pick players out, bring them into one environment. It doesn't
100%.
have to be the 12-month environment, but like it can be an environment where we check in every once in a while, we bring them together, we have a good thing, and then they kind of move on. Maybe that should only last for the younger age groups or something. I don't know.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like we can have that conversation another time, but ultimately, why does Matt Crocker for US soccer quit 3 months before the World Cup when he's trying to push through, the US soccer way, and he's just facing nothing but roadblock, 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 roadblock the whole way because of the way that we have things structured here. Because the way we have things structured here don't match up to what has proven to be the path to develop players consistently over time. And until we're able to face that reality and then start to make decisions that are going to cause harm to the current
Right.
environment, we're not going to see the change that we want to see. And I think as you as college, not just college soccer, but fans of soccer in general as Americans, it's extremely frustrating. It's extremely frustrating to see a rich country like ours, with such a passion for sport and success, not be able to, stop tripping over their own feet.
Right. Talking, okay, so the other one that's coming up here, and this one, I think 5 for 5 is probably going to pass. I would give it an 80% chance. This next one, I think, is 50-50 at best, only because I know college administrators well enough, and I know how hard things are financially out there for a
Yeah.
lot of schools. But it's the 2-semester model.
Yep.
The 21st century model or the 2-semester model, basically splitting up the soccer season into 2 semesters. And it's like I don't know. What do you think about that? And what are you hearing?
Yeah, I think, obviously the sport body for the NCAA men's soccer has approved it. That was something that happened last couple of weeks. However, there's still another step in the process, which is sometimes goes again when you get into your silos of social media, and we have started to have discussions about this, that, and the other. All of a sudden, you see, was it Men in Blazers put out a text that says, hey, full year model for Division I men's soccer has passed, and now everybody thinks it's going to happen next
Yeah, I
year.
know. It drives me crazy every time I
That's
see
just
that.
not how things work, right?
Right.
Although it is a step in the right direction. And obviously, they're putting that out because they believe that is a step in the right direction for development of the game in the United States further. We have not had a change in the men's soccer calendar since what, 1950, right? So, and then there's been discussion of this year-long model back from when I was in school, which is in 2005, right? So this has been an
Right.
ongoing discussion. Now we've gotten to the point where we've got the sport body to approve it, and now we're waiting for, I believe, the executive board in the NCAA, which consists of presidents from around the United States of universities, as well as like ADs and some other administrators. So, where will that get approved? I know the conversation on my campus goes is probably very similar to a lot of other mid-majors. We're now going to have to either hire a new AT to be able to cover the sport for the whole year, because
Right.
traditionally what men's soccer has done and most mid-majors is we split with like softball, for example, right? They're in the
Right.
fall or they're in the spring. We're in the fall. We can share an AT, helps cover the cost. The other thing could be sports administrators goes further. When you have the experience for Division One athletics and really any athletic department, at the college level, is yes, at the NCAA, you're required to have a sport administrator at every one of your games. So you need somebody to cover your home game. Then you also need then there's the support staff. There's the ATs and stuff like that, but there's also the sports information directors. And everybody that has to write the stories and be involved and engaged. So the busiest time in an athletic department in college sport for majority of them is actually the early spring, right? The early spring. You've got both basketballs going, track and field is typically in their indoor season. You've got baseball and softball getting ready to kick off. We have a stunt team here on campus, so that's a team that's kind of going at that
Lacrosse
time.
for some schools.
Lacrosse for some schools. You've got, and then baseball and softball, obviously we mentioned before, but those are coming around the corner. So if we go to a full semester model and we say right now, I think the date to kind of start your second preseason is what, February 15th or 18th or something. Well, there's a lot going on a campus at that time. And if even if you do provide 2 weeks of run up into March, you still have March Madness around the corner. You have everything else that kind of goes involved. So, like, who's going to be there to help support? Now, the new model that's being suggested has put into place a lot of flexibility. So you do, as an institution, individual institution, as well as conferences, have this space to be really creative on how you can kind of place the games around. And it's up to you and your conference to kind of decide. The only things that has been said, the minimums is still the same minimums as the fall. You got to play 10 games in the fall, and you got to play at least 3 games in the spring so that you have 13 games. Because right now, and then under the current rules, it's 13 games in order to be eligible to make the national tournament, right? So that stays the same. You also have the amount of days that you can have, with your CARA logs or your countable athletic related activity. So to kind of explain what that is. Anyways, but under that, you still have a certain amount of days that you can actually have contact with your players. That's not
Right.
changed. It stayed the same. The maximum amount of games that you can play under the two semester model, still the same as it would be in our current model. It's just that what the only thing that's changed is you've traditionally what happens right now is Division One teams are going to play two or three preseason games, non friendly games. Then you're going to play probably 15, 16 regular season games. Then you either qualify for your conference tournament or you don't. And then you have postseason play that goes conference tournament, national tournament. That all happens in the fall. If you go to this model, you basically can play, you have to play 10 in the fall, right? But you can play more. And there have been conferences that have already said, we're going to play our full allotment in the fall. We're not going to change, right? Including their conference tournament in the fall. But the only thing is you have to be done before, was it Thanksgiving weekend, right? That's the really the cutoff date for the fall. So then you come back in the spring. February 18th is really the first, like the new preseason. But before that, you're in your non-competitive season, which is basically what our spring is now, anyways. So you can still do 4 hours with your strength coach, 4 hours with your current team as soon as you get back in January. And you do that all the way up till, February 18th. And then you can start your preseason time. And then that rolls on. So the amount of days has not changed, right? The amount of, so you essentially can play 20 in the new model, you can play 20 regular season games, 5 friendly games. Right now, in the old model, you get 3 friendlies in preseason, right? And then you get 5 play dates in the spring. You can get a sixth if you play an international tour team or whatever, right?
Right.
Those are the current rules. So the amount of games that you're able to play hasn't really changed. We're just spreading them out. That's all that's happened. And some of I guess my concerns with all this is obviously you have the concerns on the campuses, the facilities, the administration support, the athletic trainers, all those things are going to cost a little bit of money. It's been noted that you no longer have to bring kids into preseason, so you save a little bit of money and not paying for kids being in dorms or whatever, 2, 3, 4 weeks before school starts. So you've kind of got you save a little bit of money there. But ultimately, if you got two hats you can wear the hat of your individual school and how these rules are going to change, or affect your program. But then you also can put on the hat of what's the right thing for the game and how we can continue to improve the competitive environment within college soccer in the context of the world's game. I think that this is a step in the right direction. And if I strictly have on the right for the what's right for the game hat, I would say that it's just the first step. And there's plenty of more steps that need to take place in order for us to kind of create the best environment possible for this age group of men from 18, 19 years old to 23, 24 in these college environments, that still is yet to take place, even with these changes, right? So, however, if you go and put on just the program hat, the mid-majors, how does this affect you? Well, yeah, there's conversations about, are we going to lose programs? Our program's going to be cut. Are they going to
That's
just
one of
say
the
that we're going to
conversations that
drop?
scares me. Yeah.
Right? I
And
mean,
it's
we've already
legit.
said we don't have enough of them. If anything, what should we be trying to do at the college level? We should be trying to find ways to have more programs, right? I mean, I live in the South right now. How many SEC men's soccer programs are
Yeah,
there?
right.
How many Big 12 soccer programs are there?
Right.
There's two SEC and there's no Big 12, right? And that
Right.
predominantly dominates this area of the country when it comes to sport in general, right? Because this area of the country doesn't have a lot of professional teams, right? Or they're limited. So colleges are big. University sport is really taking that space. So if those teams, if those programs, those universities don't have men's soccer programs, then you're leaving a whole section
Yeah.
of the country out of the conversation of extending the ability to develop players. So that's a whole nother part of it. But for me personally, at UCA, we have the support of our athletic director to kind of move forward in terms of the ASUN, our conference. We have discussions yet to be had on how we are going to adapt and adjust to these new rules if they were to be passed. However, I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's not necessarily everything that needs to be done. There still needs to be conversations about RPI. There needs to be conversations about regionalization. I think there needs to be conversations about scheduling, in order to continue to make, again, this space the best it can be, for the players and for the sport.
I couldn't agree more on just about every level, man. This has been a terrible podcast because you and I agree way too much. There's no fighting here, man. There's no fighting here. No, and I think part of it is that both of us have coached at so many different levels. I think is part of it. I think that that's a it's a perspective that that you bring that a lot of the coaches that I've talked to really don't have. They've only coached at one level or in one area of the country, but I think you've got this fresh perspective because of coaching on the West Coast and in the Midwest and now in the South and at all these different levels. And I want to have you back on as if you're up for it, if
Absolutely.
you're up for it, as things continue to develop, because I think you really represent this every coach in America perspective, not just the elite, not just the top, and I think you bring a really fresh perspective, and I think this has been a good episode for parents who are going to want to go back and listen to a couple of times.
I appreciate that. I mean, I'd love to be on anytime, discuss more about things that we do differently here at UCA that might be, than others. But ultimately, to kind of close things or how to say things in closing, it would just be, this is a mad, mad time that we're all living in. We're all trying to figure it out. We all, I think, try to enter the conversation with, with the right intentions. But when another thing to keep in mind is whether it be age group changes as we kind of move back from the
Yeah.
club level, they're moving back
Third time
to
we've
the
changed
August
this, by
1st,
the
like third
way.
time we changed, right? I can remember when the first one came through, and I was in Ohio running a youth club at the time, and I was sitting with the state director at the moment, and he's saying, change is hard, change is hard, and what we really need in this moment is a clarity of like which direction is best for the sport, best for the players, right? And ultimately what's best for universities. There's space there. There's space for us to find that answer. And we need to continue to work towards those things together. But the other thing I think is really important is we need to have empathy. We need to have the ability to put ourselves in the shoes of other people and see things from their point of view. And then try to approach the conversation together, because we all have unique experience. We're all coming from different perspectives. But ultimately, when change comes, some scary things can happen. People start freaking out because they're worried that their livelihoods are going to be taken away, right? And when that's a reality, people make decisions or do things that are selfish, and that's normal. You're human. You're going to do that. Right.
Yeah.
But can we find ways to still have conversations about this will help protect and insulate men's soccer, as well as this is the direction that we need to go if we're going to continue to really say that this is high performance environments best for the game? Right. Because yes, we do have a responsibility to develop the American player. And I think college soccer provides a crucible for that American player, if they enter it in with the right mindset and the right and the right values to kind of make it through.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I always go back to the episode I did with Bruce Murray, good friend of mine, and Bruce said, we talked about did you think about playing pro? Were you thinking about playing on the national team? He goes, look, Don, at every level, I just wanted to continue to play soccer. That was it. How do I continue to play? And I think that's a conversation that probably isn't had enough, and that's just playing for the love of the game, man. Look, if you're good enough, you're gonna. No true superstar goes undetected. I mean, people talk, and it is as big as our country is. Soccer is a small community, and people do find out about players. People do talk about players, and if we just continue to get these kids to play because they love it, then they'll end up raising kids who love the game, and eventually superstars come out of that, and our level as a country rises. I just don't want to see kids get burnt out at 15, 16, 17, and then end up hating the game. I want to see them continue to play as long as they want to play, and as long as they love the game, and then they will raise kids who feel the same way about our game, and it's gonna take and it's gonna take time, but it's gonna eventually pass on from generation to generation into America being a true soccer powerhouse. It's going to happen. I have no doubt it's going to happen. I've seen this game grow way too big for me playing in the 70s. It's a
No, I mean,
lot
it
better.
is. I think if Don, if we were to ask coach to coach, you know, when you were in recruiting players for college teams, you know, compared to the players that you see now on the field competing at 18, 19 years old, I would say overwhelmingly the American player has improved. Would you agree with that?
Tremendously.
Yeah, the
Oh,
overall player,
yeah,
overall American
tremendously.
player has absolutely improved. But
Yeah.
you got to continue to keep things in perspective. The rest of the world's gotten better too,
Yeah.
right? So our trajectory, our velocity of change might be higher or, you know, a greater slope than others, but we've not yet caught up, right? And there
Right.
are some things that are preventing us to do that. And that's what I, you know, alluded to earlier, where I get frustrated as a young American coach who's done a lot of things, been in a lot of environments, in no way thinks he's the best coach in the world, but like sees things from a worldly perspective and says, this is incredibly frustrating to see us continue to trip over our own feet.
Yeah, I agree. That's probably a good synopsis of it. I think I agree completely. Yeah. Well, Kyle, let's do this again. Let's do this again real soon. We've got the World Cup happening. I'm sure
Yeah,
you guys will be watching that. Maybe we can
absolutely.
talk a little bit about that as it goes on and gets closer to the season. But let's do this again real soon.
Sounds great, Don. Appreciate it. Always enjoy
Thanks,
talking to you.
brother.
All right, talk
Appreciate
to
you.
you. See ya. Bye-bye.